It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show, a program where all Bible questions are answered. At least we will take all Bible questions. Sometimes people like the answers, sometimes they don't. Sometimes the Bible's really clear. Sometimes the Bible is not so clear. When it's not, I will admit that. Today is a situation where there are some differences of opinion. I feel pretty strongly about where I stand, but I can understand why some people take a look at verses a little differently here. And yet that's not the real problem, as I'm about to point out. My friends, as you know, I also talk about news and politics on this show, and I am not one of those Christians who shies away from politics or thinks Christians should shy away from politics. However, there are some people who will falsely claim that a certain biblical view exists only because of a prior political view. This is often the case with end times prophecy and end times theology. What do I mean by that? Well, specifically, the belief that Jesus will literally return someday to the nation of Israel to rescue her from attacking enemies and then rule the entire world with Israel as a headquarters where the throne is. There are prophecies in Daniel 9 which talk about a seven-year tribulation. There are other discussions about that tribulation. The seven-year period is used in Revelation. It's talked about more generally in Matthew 24 and 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Well, what is the seven-year tribulation exactly? We don't know everything about it, but we know it's going to be a horrible time. It's called the greatest tribulation this world has ever known. And it's being ruled over by a man sometimes called the Antichrist in Scripture, sometimes called the Son of Perdition, sometimes called the Lawless One, all referring to the same person. He rules this world for 7 years. The first 3.5, he's deceiving a lot of people. His pure evil comes out and is made known in the last 3.5 years. He insists on being worshipped as God. He goes into the Jewish temple, which will somehow be rebuilt before then. He goes into the Holy of Holies. He proclaims himself to be God. Anyway, all this is going on before Jesus returns. Jesus defeats the Antichrist and other armies about to attack Israel and then rules the entire world, we're told, for a period of 1,000 years, known in the vernacular as the millennium. And those that don't believe this will happen call themselves amillennialists. Amills, and they're not the only ones, but they're the ones most popularly known for taking this position. They dismiss this teaching. They too consider themselves Christians. They too claim they believe in the authority of Scripture, but they dismiss this teaching. While it is found in the Bible, they understand it's there. They know what we're reading. They claim we're reading it too literally, that it's only symbolic. They claim such a belief supports Zionism. And when they drop the word Zionism into the conversation, it often seems to be suggesting that Zionism is a bad thing. I'm not claiming that every amill is anti-Zionist, but I'm just saying when they bring that up to win their argument, like, well, if you believe this, you're really supporting Zionism. Well, obviously, if that's a tactic they're using to win the argument, they're assuming going into the conversation that we shouldn't be for Zionism. In fact, many today use Zionism as if it's a four-letter word. Well, what about Zionism being linked to the end times, the second coming of Christ, interpretations of Daniel 9 and other scriptures? My friends, listen to me carefully. Zionism is merely the belief that Jews are entitled to their own homeland. Most Jewish Zionists do not even believe in the Bible. They could care less about Daniel or the seven-year tribulation. They don't even believe in the Old Testament, let alone the New. Many of the Zionists who started the Nation of Israel, the revived Nation of Israel, early in the 20th century, they were atheists. Many of them today are still atheists or agnostics. They could care less about any prophetic portion of Scripture. As for Christians, a Christian who embraces Zionism is articulating no obligation to any one view of end times prophecy. Anti-Zionists are often anti-Semites, although, to be fair, with all the false historical revision about how Jews stole their land from the Palestinians, I am willing to give the benefit of the doubt to another possibility, sincere ignorance. Either way, regardless of your view, one has nothing to do with the other. One can be pro-Israel and not believe in the seven-year tribulation or the literal second coming of Christ to Israel. Conversely, one can be on the side of the Palestinians and still believe there is Bible prophecy yet to be fulfilled regarding Israel. The inability of people to separate political human rights issues and prophecy interpretation has caused great confusion. Here's hoping I just did a little to clear the confusion up. I'm Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? Why does the Bible call premarital sex a sin? How will God judge the people who never heard of Jesus? These are but some of the critical concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob Siegel tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book will be enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you've followed my radio shows over the years or my podcasts, there's a subject that's come up often in dialogues with guests or call-in listeners or atheists invited to come on the program for respectful debate, and this is what I call the moral argument for the existence of God. There are all kinds of arguments offered by Christian apologists, many of them scientific, some philosophical. I get into the philosophical ones myself. And frankly, some of these arguments are better than others. The one I have found the most effective is this moral argument. It's never been explained away. Oh, I meet people who think they have and they're proud that they have. But as we continue talking, their points are rebutted quite easily. Now, once again, some review. There's a difference between proof and evidence. Evidence is that which points to a high probability that a given claim is true. Proof is something we experience and witness with our own senses. There is another kind of proof, a mathematical proof. That's not what I'm talking about today. Today, this argument is based on evidence. It will point to a high probability that there is a God. So when you get into this and somebody says, well, you still haven't proven that there's a God, I'm saying, dude, I didn't claim I was going to prove it. But much of what we accept in life as facts come to us on the basis of evidence. Have you ever been to Australia? Some of you have, some of you haven't. I'm talking now to those who have never been to Australia. Let me ask you a question. Does Australia exist? You're saying to yourself, what are you talking about? Of course it exists. Well, how do you know? You haven't been there. Until you've been there, it has not been proven to you. Even then, a strict empiricist could say, just because you thought you went to Australia, how do you know you weren't hallucinating? In fact, how do you know all of life isn't a hallucination? Maybe you're the only one in the whole universe exists and everything's an illusion going through your mind. Yeah, see, there's always things we can question. But we don't live our lives that way. When I'm out at a university and we set up our table and somebody comes by and says, show me evidence for Christianity, I assume he or she will use their senses to examine the evidence. So we stipulate the senses. And within the realm of senses, if we have not witnessed something personally, we don't know for sure if it happened. If you were sitting on a jury, even there, they tell you to make a decision beyond reasonable doubt because they know there can always be some doubt. You listen to different eyewitnesses. Yes, I saw this person hold up the store. Yes, I saw this person walk in with a gun. Yes, I saw this person run away. Usually what they want is more than one witness, so there's corroboration. But face it, you can always sit there and go, well, I wasn't there myself. Maybe this is some hoax. Maybe this is some conspiracy theory. There's always a maybe. There's always a possibility. There's always a what if. But in life, we navigate with the best information available to us. Therefore, what I am offering you is evidence for the existence of God. That was a definition that I needed to review before starting. So again, you've heard these points that I'm going to go through today come up a lot in conversation. What's going to be different today is that instead of hearing these points in the midst of dialogue, I'm going to back up and walk through the argument as if I were teaching a class, Existence for God 401, something like that. I actually have taught this as a class many times, not just at churches. I've taught at universities. I've been a guest speaker in classrooms. I've developed my own classes. I've gone to Bible colleges, all kinds of places where I've taught this. And I will be saying things similar to a written version of mine, a chapter from my book on Christian apologetics called I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... By the way, whenever you hear me mention books, I'm not trying to sell you anything. Keep your money. Just contact me and I would be happy to order you a complimentary copy off of Amazon. Now, it's got to be within reason. Don't get together with your atheist friends and say, hey, let's order 3,000 of those and then burn them. I know you wouldn't really do that. I'm just exaggerating. Anyway, my point is, if you personally really believe you would take the time to read the book, I'd be happy to send you one. You can reach me through my website, bobsiegel.net. By the way, there is too much material here for one podcast, especially since I just used up a bunch of time with all these introductions. We will barely scratch the surface today, and then I will continue this topic as an ongoing series on The Bob Siegel Show. On college campuses over the years, I have frequently brought attention to my outdoor open forums by putting up a large challenging sign. In bold letters, students walk by and read the question, is atheism consistent? Now, the sign is not intended as an insult. It is instead an attempted return to the rich heritage of universities in which different philosophies were constantly tested and debated. Debates can be done civilly, with respect, although I must admit that these days the appearance of such a sign looks unusual and provocative. It's the times we live in. Still, it does bring people around. Before long, I am confronted by that first brave soul, usually some confident-looking intellectual who is just ready to teach this dumb Christian a thing or two. Why is atheism inconsistent? He asks. I say because nobody lives as an atheist. If we cannot live according to our own philosophy, the philosophy becomes questionable. Now, as you can probably guess, he's thinking, what are you talking about? I live consistently as an atheist. I don't believe in God. The Bible has nothing to do with my life. I think most religious people are morons. You see, in his mind, he's living very consistent as an atheist. And not all atheists are like that. I've had many friendly, civil, well-mannered atheists on my program. I've had atheists who are not arrogant. But if arrogance is going to find a home anywhere, it's certainly going to be at the college campus. certainly the arrogant will be amongst the students. Anyway, this guy's telling me, this person, I don't live as an atheist. And I say, I believe you. I believe you sincerely think that God doesn't exist. I believe you live your life seldom, if ever, thinking about God. But if God did not exist, certain other truths would follow. Neither you nor anyone else live consistently with the implications of his non-existence. At this point, he says, "What do you mean by that?" Now he's asking me a question. Now we can have a conversation. What are the implications of God's non-existence? If God did not exist, what else would have to also be true? Well, let's back up a little bit. There are only three possibilities that account for our universe. I'm telling you, any theory, be it scientific, be it philosophical, any theory would have to fall under one of these three broad, and they're very broad, one of these three broad categories. First, there was a time when the universe did not exist, and it came about by accident apart from a creator. The second theory, the universe just always existed. Maybe it changed form here and there, but there's always been a universe. The universe itself is eternal. So the universe doesn't need a creator. The universe itself is just as far back as we go. And the third possibility, it had a creator or creators. Now, my fellow Christians, we need to be careful here. I'm talking to you as one who is absolutely convinced that the God of the Bible is God, that the God of the Bible came down as Jesus incarnate. But when I'm in a philosophical discussion, we need to talk hypothetically. We need to back up and get into the heads of the ones we're talking to. So hypothetically, talking about God with a capital G, talking about there being some kind of creator, that doesn't automatically translate into the God of Christianity, into the God of the Bible. That's a different argument. We'll get to that, but we're not there yet. And so that's why I say that the third possibility is it has a creator or creators. Do I believe in creators in the plural? No, I believe in one creator. But to enter this discussion with an open mind, we must admit the initial possibility of several creators. Of course, the purpose of opening your mind is to examine the data and then eventually close your mind. But if you're talking to somebody with an open mind or who's claiming to have an open mind, you need to go back and say, I understand that from your point of view, evidence for a creator doesn't necessarily go to the Bible. So for the sake of easier communication, I am going to refer to the idea of creator or creators with the familiar word God and the familiar gender pronoun he. You may not like that, but these are just conventional reference points. I can't stop every minute and go, well, God or gods, he or she. It would be very cumbersome. So theories A and B would indicate that life is meaningless. Our intuitive and universal belief that life should have meaning had to come from somewhere. Even those who aren't searching for a general purpose to life often think about personal value. The very idea of such value had to have a source. Therefore, we can conclude that value and meaning came from a source outside of ourselves. Theories A and B do not account for such possibilities. For this reason, we are left with theory C, some kind of God exists. I know, that went by awfully fast. I'm the kind of guy that likes to give the bottom line right away, quickly. Then I go back and with detail defend the bottom line. Here then is the defense. People can claim to live without a sense of God, but the real truth of the matter is that no one lives as if he or she were here by accident. And I should say here, I've had many atheists talk to me and come on my radio show, and they don't like the word accident. They find it insulting to say that if God doesn't exist, they're here by accident. And I'll just tell them, well, what do you call it? And then they'll come up with other kinds of alternative words, but the alternative words mean the same thing. I said, maybe you don't like the word accident, but if you're assuming things move according to some kind of process or plan, you can't have a plan without a planner. So anyway, I'm going to use the word accident. I know a lot of people don't like the word accident. My friends, if there is no creator, but you exist anyway, then you just happen to exist. Oh, but Bob, evolution is a process. We'll talk about evolution in a moment because there are theistic evolutionists. My point is, if a process comes without God, that process itself exists by accident. I know that sounds bizarre, but that's my whole point. We live as if life is not bizarre. We live as if life moves according to a purpose. Once when asking a skeptical science student how our beautiful and complicated world came about by mere chance, I was exposed to an interesting answer. He says, look, it took billions and billions and billions of years. It only makes sense that things would finally come out right. I said, what do you mean by right? If life is an accident, there's no such thing as right, and there's no such thing as wrong. If life is an accident, what is just is. All opinions about right and wrong would be just that, opinions. My friends, do you consider yourselves to have personal worth? Do you attach importance to your life? Would you expect from others the same respect, appreciation, love, and acceptance that they would expect from you? Do you feel a need to discover personal gifts and talents so as to make a valid contribution of some sort? Would you be bored and discontent doing unfulfilled work? Would you be satisfied with mere survival apart from happiness? Is happiness even possible apart from what was just mentioned? If not, then we stand in full agreement. Without personal value, life is chaotic. At the same time, if humans don't have a universal purpose, there is really no such thing as genuine value. Value becomes a mere invention. Value becomes a hopeless dream. All that we work for, fight for, and stand for is ultimately unimportant. Even if we can't find this purpose behind life, the acceptance of a mystery is preferable to disbelief. Without such meaning, individual pursuit turns into vanity. We very much like to feel that someday, somehow, our experience will count for something. But without God, such an idea is nonsense. Why? Because there can never be a purpose behind accidental creatures. That's what the word accident means. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to run into you on purpose. It was an accident. The opposite of purpose is accident. Just think, success, freedom, human rights, none of these virtues have any coherence apart from the notion that we are genuinely precious. You're thinking, well, Bob, maybe life is an accident. Maybe we simply create value in our minds to enjoy ourselves more. All right, well, then let me ask you, why does one need to create value to enjoy himself more? Why do you feel the need to do that? If we really don't have value, where did such a preposterous idea originate? Well, maybe our thoughts of value were also an accident. Not everybody agrees as to what is important and what isn't. Well, certainly variations exist, my friend. They do exist, but we agree on more than the average person takes time to notice. The ultimate certainty for human worth is frequently ignored, yet obvious as your own thumbnail. I am referring to the conscience, that inward reflection appraising all thoughts, all motives, and all actions. With unexplained intuition, people sense a responsibility to live with ethics. This is a firm contradiction to the theory of chance existence. If my neighbor is a mere accident, I owe my neighbor nothing. I am without moral obligation. After all, where would a mere fluke obtain the right to pass judgment? There could be no standard with which to measure his or her idea. Let us for a moment examine the obvious. Why would we consider it despicable to lie, cheat, steal, or murder? Why does one feel bothered over a selfish, inconsiderate decision? In fact, why should it be inhumane to walk on the street and shoot the first person we see? Now, I know what you're thinking. People do that all the time, Bob. Yeah, they do. How do you feel about it? I'm talking just to you. We pass judgment about it. We make laws about it. And even the people that do it have consciences condemning them. All right. This is where we begin. I know I'm just whetting your appetite. I know that every comment I make is raising a million questions and objections. We will continue this on The Bob Siegel Show.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.